From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
President Obama and the curse of the second term. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. High ratings in public opinion polls help President Obama weather financial crises, withstand relentless Republican opposition, and win re-election. Now his ratings are dropping. The disastrous rollout of healthcare.gov and his own misleading statements are obvious reasons. Critics see inexperience and bad management. Even supporters say he's failed to communicate well with the public. Does the president have time to restore his image and pursue his agenda before being overtaken by the inevitable lame duck status of a second term? Today's talking point: was last year's presidential campaign another game changer? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. President Obama's Affordable Care Act is the biggest new government program since Medicare, but the disastrous rollout is threatening his second term. Can he restore public confidence before he becomes a lame duck? Today's talking point: Double Down, an account of last year's presidential campaign by the authors of Game Change about the campaign of 2008. We'll ask the co-author Mark Halperin to compare and contrast. First, this news update: as negotiations over nuclear development resumed today in Geneva, there were signs that Washington is prepared to offer Iran a deal to reduce economic sanctions. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Zarif, talked of a possible breakthrough. Michael Gordon is reporting the story for the New York Times. Good to have you back on our program.
Good to be here.
Tell us, if you will, what is this program being offered by the United States? I take it as it is a phased program.
Yes, they actually call it the first step. That's the name they've given to it. And it's intended to be basically a set of limited constraints that the Iranians would accept on their nuclear program, which would not eliminate the program, but would constrain the program from moving forward in return for very limited sanctions relief. And the concept would be that it would essentially freeze the situation for, say, 6 months or so, so that more comprehensive negotiations could be undertaken in that period. Because Iran's program has progressed so far, they really feel like they have to freeze it just to have the time to negotiate.
You've reported also that in addition to freezing it, they then have to reverse a part of it. What would that mean?
Well, they haven't, the Americans haven't said, but the basic concept is when Iran's program has been progressing for years, even while they've fitfully negotiated with the West. This is all before President Rouhani took over and displayed at least publicly interest in seeking a solution. And so things have gotten to the point where, by some estimates, let's say Iran could assemble a crude nuclear device in 2 or 3 months if it made the political decision to do so. So what, from the American, from the White House's standpoint, let's say, the idea is to kind of freeze the clock or roll back some aspects of the program so that they have the time to pursue a more comprehensive agreement, which would probably be a very complicated undertaking. That's the philosophy behind it, and that's what may indeed come together this week.
Well, now, Mohammad Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, is a very accomplished diplomat. He is well-known, well-liked by many Americans. Is he premature, do you think, in saying that there might be a breakthrough?
No, the Iranians have launched what could be called the charm offensive, where they're trying to shape public opinion in the West and encourage concessions on the part of Western nations by holding out the prospect of a so-called breakthrough. So they're operating in privately, and they're operating in the public domain, just as the Obama administration is. So that's just part of their strategy. They've been very public and doing all sorts of interviews with all sorts of news outlets.
So all this was said before the negotiations began. How much longer are they going to go on, as far as you know?
Well, I mean, this is a two-day set of talks. So we're talking about today and tomorrow. But what's interesting is the negotiations are not yet over. They haven't yet announced anything, although there's the expectation that they might tomorrow, Friday. But already it's stirring up enormous debate. I mean, in Israel, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has already condemned it as I think he called it an era of historic proportions. And the people on the other side are already defending it. Is the last best chance to pull Iran back from the nuclear threshold. So you have a rather intense debate going on about an agreement that hasn't yet been consummated yet or announced.
The nations involved in the negotiations include not just the U.S. and Iran, but also Britain, France, Russia, China, and Germany. Why are they part of this?
Well, I mean, it's called the P5 plus one. It's the permanent members of the Security Council. It's essentially a conglomeration of Security Council permanent members and the European Union. And some of them, like France, are particularly concerned, perhaps even more so than the United States, about the Iran's nuclear program. So this is a negotiation not solely between the United States and Iran, but between really world powers in Iran, although it's interesting that the United States has maintained bilateral channels even during these sets of talks. They do their separate meetings with the Iranians, and then they do their group meetings as well.
Is it the U.S. that's the primary enforcer of the economic sanctions?
No, the European Union also has economic sanctions. And the situation's complex because in the United States, many of the sanctions are congressionally kind of mandated, and the executive branch doesn't have it within its power to simply waive them, or it couldn't waive them without enormous political costs. And also, there's a sense that if they do succeed here tomorrow, really what they'll be doing is freezing the program, not ending it. So the United States does not want to relinquish all of the sanctions merely to freeze a program in place. But from the Iranian perspective, they're looking for sanctions relief. And so a question remains whether not merely what the Iranians will agree to do, but whether the West can offer enough by way of sanctions relief to satisfy the Iranians.
Okay. Michael Gordon, National Security Council correspondent for the New York Times, reporting from Geneva. Thanks a lot for being on our program. In a moment, President Obama and the curse of the second term on To the Point.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. More than a dozen Democratic senators spent 2 hours with the president this week venting frustrations. Two of them complained in public about a crisis of confidence. They're talking about the flawed rollout of healthcare.gov and the president's misleading promise that the people who liked their health insurance policies would be able to keep them when the Affordable Care Act went into effect. Stanley Greenberg is a Democratic pollster who saw problems coming back in July. Stanley Greenberg, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. The curse of the second term.
Indeed. You wrote in the New Republic in July a lengthy piece that began, "We need a serious and sustained presidential conversation," and that was about the Affordable Care Act. We didn't get that sustained presidential conversation. What did you mean, and did you foresee that there would be problems to come?
Well, regrettably, and the I actually wrote that piece within in hopes that it would help become part of the way they approach the educating the public on the issue. And I'm actually hoping that the you know, the concentrating your mind, watching the poll numbers, you know, fall to probably 43% on average, with a majority disapprove, that that will concentrate the mind on the need to do this in different ways. Now they are, you know, they are obviously. He's spending a lot of time on this, but I think the major problem is just the overall narrative for healthcare, which is what I was calling for in that earlier piece. Right now, they have sold this as minimal change. If you kept your, you know, the, and everything is playing off of that concept. And by the way, I was for that. That was a very important concept on getting this passed, and that's historic. We worked on the President Clinton. We did not get close to getting it passed. So getting it passed is monumental. But it was reassurance. You know, 85%, not going to see any change. If your employer has insurance, it's not going to change. If you have Medicare, it's not going to change. So the reassurance to get things passed through the Congress was critical. But once it passed, they really should have moved to the step of saying, this is transformational. You know, we are changing the character of insurance. We are, as a community, saying that we're going to share risks. We're saying we have values. Of you know, personal responsibility, and not passing on our costs to other people. There are real values that we have as a community that the health care law is central to. Had we been talking about transformational change, we are changing the whole character of insurance. So insurance really is insurance. You wouldn't be in this debate over whether the 6 million people, you know, in the personal insurance market. You know, are going to have a better or a weaker policy. Of course it's going to be better. Of course it's going to be change. Of course there's going to be a change in the policies. And so there needed to be a framework, and I, you know, unfortunately, I think the president is too much, you know, sounding like an insurance salesman, talking about, you know, how, you know, the different kinds of policies. But I have to say, that said, he's still much more aligned with where the country is than the Republicans in terms of, you know, repeal and replace. Yeah, it's a minority of the country that wants to go that road. So he's aligned with the country that wants to see this succeed. What I hope is this is a moment where we step up to a much bigger narrative.
If he had followed the procedure that you recommended, you couldn't possibly have anticipated, I presume, the problems with healthcare.gov, but would they have seemed less important?
The website's a, you know, it's a disaster, a debacle, whatever the, you know, the word is. And so there's, you know, there's, I mean, but one can, I think that becomes diminished if you're making the case for transformational change. If you're, I mean, this is 17% of the economy. We are changing in a fundamental way, the way people, you know, purchase health insurance and what it covers and the ability to depend on it. And the focus is not on the operation of the website. It's in changing the underlying values on which we are going to have people pay for health insurance and insure for risk. And that's an immense change. He could be talking about the tremendous changes for women and gender equality through, you know, transformational changes. You know, through, now, the president has spoken about those. But if your framework is there's not going to be much change, then when you talk about the big changes, how can we have not have big change but have big change? And so, yes, I think this would have been, there'd been much more perspective, and I think ability to push back the reporters. I think the reporting on this has been monumentally misleading, without any perspective. And I think that, you know, I think the media has, you know, some responsibility for not bringing to the table a whole range of changes that are taking place at the same time they deal with these areas where the changes aren't taking place. And so I think the press has been really has concentrated this in ways that I think are very misleading. But still, have the president been able to say, look, these are transformational changes. These are big changes. Of course, that's going to require, you know, that people move to different kinds of policy.
Okay. Stanley Greenberg, again, a Democratic pollster, CEO of Greenberg Quinlan Rossner Research. David Winston is a Republican pollster and strategist. He's president of the Winston Group. Good to have you back on our show.
Glad to be here.
So Stanley Greenberg seems to think this is principally a public relations problem, that he says the president's sounding like an insurance salesman too much, and that he is, however, very much in line with the country, which really wants to see this transformational change. If it only knew that was what was taking place. What do you think?
I think Stanley is right in the sense of what the president was trying to do and the way he was portraying it were two different things. Where I would disagree with him is I think at that point in time, you had, what, about three-quarters of the country that was satisfied with their health care, right? And you had 25% who weren't. And so the idea of telling that 75% that they needed transformational change would probably have been somewhat disruptive, which is why I think the White House took the path they did, where the president kept reaffirming you can keep the health care that you the health insurance that you have, now you can keep your doctor, specifically because there was such a large portion of the electorate that, in fact, was satisfied. Now, having said that, there's a difference between being being happy with your health care and thinking the health care system is addressing the needs of the country. And I think there were, you know, you're looking at quite a few people who also thought having that percentage of people or number, not using a percentage, but number of people being uninsured was a problem that the country clearly needed to address. But the White House was stuck with the problem of how do you generate that kind of change without terrifying everybody about their health care. And what's happening now is, yes, they took that particular route, and now they're running into the reality of what they've done. And people who thought that, in fact, their health care wasn't going to change is now changing in a way that they're unhappy with, and I think creates a real challenge for this White House as it tries to move forward and promoting the health care plan. If I may, Warren, going back to the website, I think the website is a temporary thing. You know, it obviously doesn't help the president to not have it work the way he wanted it to. But I don't think that's – and it may make the government look bad in terms of implementing things, but ultimately in terms of the success or failure of this health care law, it's going to be around the policies, not around a website.
So you disagree with Stanley Greenberg on both points. So you think that given the transformational nature, if that's the right term, or the size and magnitude of the plan, they took the right strategy by de-emphasizing that aspect of it because they didn't want to scare people. But you also think that the country is not in favor of the Affordable Care Act as well. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, most surveys sort of reflect that. I mean, that by a 10-point margin, you have more people opposing it than supporting it. And again, for a lot of people, their health care was fine. The problem that they thought needed to be addressed was there were so many Americans who didn't have health care. And what were we going to do to ensure that they got health care? That was the problem that people wanted to have addressed. And so the idea that we were going to transform everybody's health care for 75% of Americans was not a problem facing them. Again, like I said, what they wanted to address was how do we deal with those people who didn't have access to the health care system and how do we handle that problem?
Okay, let's leave for the moment the fact that you disagree in a couple of ways and rather than going back and forth on it. And Stanley Greenberg, I want to ask you more about this article you wrote in July because you also said that the inability of the president to fashion public clarity on his major policy initiatives is hardly confined to health care reform. What did you mean by that?
Well, I would say, you know, if you look at what the president has done on the economy, he faced a financial crisis. He did have transformational change at the outset. Extraordinary measures to rescue the economy, bring back the economy, probably save global capitalism along the way. But he barely ever had the public support or the public understanding of what he was doing. He was seen to own the TARP buyout. And if you ask people what his economic policy is, go to that simple question and say, what do you think the president's economic policy is? You know, what is the main policy? What are the underlying beliefs that underlie his economic policy? You could have no idea. But in fact, what we do know is that they might say, you know, spending. And they might say tax increases, but the fact is overwhelmingly people got a tax cut. And in fact, if you look at his economic policy, at every point, the biggest element were tax cuts. This is a tax-cutting president. You know, through his whole first term, he was a tax-cutting president, and yet no one knows. So if your core economic policy is to, you know, they had economic relief on Social Security, payroll tax in order to, you know, put money in people's pocket. A large portion, almost half of the initial Recovery Act was tax relief. This is tax relief is at the center of his economic plan, jobs plan, and yet people do not know that. If he were saying, let me say to you, what I think is the most important thing to happen in my economic policy is to try to give some economic relief to people. Tax cuts are the way to do it. And I make sure that most of that tax relief happens for those in the middle and working people and the poor. And that's my economic policy. That's what I've done at every point. The country has no idea that that's true.
Jonathan Chait is a writer for New York Magazine. I want to bring him into this conversation. Good to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You have said that there are other areas in which the president has simply failed to communicate with the public what it is that he is doing, and you think they may be the most important part of his legacy. What are they?
Well, I think the most important piece of the second-term agenda is going to be regulation of existing power plants. Now, it's a wonky issue. Most people listening don't even probably know what I'm talking about. But this could end up being, if he pulls it off, the most important thing he's done, not only in the second term, but in the entire presidency. President Obama is working on a plan to use existing authority of the Environmental Protection Agency to change and to limit the way power plants can emit greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And they have that statutory authority. The Supreme Court ordered them to carry out some kind of regulation back in 2007. Hasn't done it yet. But this would essentially give the United States a chance to be in compliance with the international obligations that it agreed to in Copenhagen several years ago and fashion a global treaty to keep the advanced countries of the world within the greenhouse gas limits and basically stop runaway climate change. So it's an enormous issue, and I think it's just oddly gone completely under the radar. But to me, when I'm evaluating the second term, whether President Obama manages to come up with this proposal, manages to get it through, and have it working by the end of his term is the number one question of the term.
So what do you think is the cause of this, then? Is the White House simply not competent to present its policies in a way that people better understand them, or has it been Republican opposition that's gotten in the way? How would you explain what's going on?
Oh, I think communication is irrelevant. They don't need Congress. They don't need an act of Congress. And because they don't need an act of Congress, they haven't felt much of a need to communicate it. Now, President Obama has given some speeches on this. He's been upfront about what he's doing, but he doesn't need to sell Congress on it. Therefore, he doesn't really need to sell the public on it very hard. And the media, for reasons I don't completely understand, is just not covering this issue at all.
David Winston, our Republican pollster, back to you. What about the media role in all of this? Are we all failing to represent the realities of this administration?
Oh, how do I say that? I mean, the media is always a sort of comfortable location for people to sort of blame when their policy message isn't getting through. Sometimes maybe it's because the problem is the policy message, not necessarily the media's interpretation of it. And all administrations, Republicans and Democrats, sort of complain about that. Having said that, I do think there's a sense of, okay, what is the priority discourse that needs to be occurring here? And ultimately, I think where the country gets frustrated, and one of the things you began to see this summer in terms of attitude about direction of the country getting significantly worse prior to the shutdown was about the economy. The sense from the public that they're getting from Washington is, where's the discussion about the topic we want to see being discussed? And one of the things that occurred in terms of the shutdown was a complete frustration with the idea that, you know, here you have this political fight going on that has nothing to do with solving the problems as people saw it. And going to Stan's point, and I do agree with him, one of the breaks the president has had is, while Republicans have opposed his health care plan, we have not offered an alternative, and that's a problem for our party. If we're going to disagree with the president on a significant signature issue like that, and not say, "And here's our option," it just creates a difficult discourse for the public out there to understand what exactly is being talked about. Well, you know, when are we going to see some progress moving forward?
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to take a break and return after just a moment. And to resume this conversation on our talking point later, was last year's presidential campaign another game changer? We'll talk to the author of a new book called Double Down. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Orrin Onley back with To the Point, with the president just barely underway in his second term, or I should say a year into his second term. His poll ratings are going down. The question is, will he be able to bring them back up? Will he be able to accomplish his remaining agenda before the second term problem sets in, of which we'll hear about a bit later? I want to introduce Matt Welch, editor-in-chief of Reason, Libertarian magazine. Thank you very much for being on our program.
It's great to be back, Warren. Thank you.
Do you think that the president has a problem with his communications strategy, as we've heard others suggest? Is it the policies themselves that are causing his ratings to go down, or is it the awful problems with the rollout and the media concentration on them?
The answer to all of that is yes, I think, Warren. I mean, clearly, the Affordable Care Act would be doing a lot better if it was doing a lot better. You can't really spin your way out of that with a more effective communications strategy. And as we talked about at the top of the show, when you are making what is effectively a transformational change and selling it as a non-transformational change, of course that's going to be a rude shock to the people who thought or believed the president when he basically said that the vast majority of people will be better off. They're not so far experiencing it that way, and that is going to be a problem. Another big problem here is just it's second-termitis. You know, there hasn't been, I don't think in my lifetime, anything like a smooth or even kind of functional second-term presidency here. You know, the mathematics on it are pretty brutal. Richard Nixon got, kicked out of office. Bill Clinton got impeached. Reagan had Iran-Contra. And as we have an increasingly polarized kind of two parties, and another important point about that, as we have a much larger group of people who don't identify with either party, the latest Gallup numbers on that are 47% of people prefer to be identified as independent, regardless of whether they're registered for. Well, those people aren't as affixed to the party or its leaders as previous generations, and so they can turn on a dime. So part of it is definitely execution on the part of Obama, and this is his signature achievement, right? This, what we're going to see in the next 3 years is whether this thing works, and the next 1 year is whether this thing works, because he's not going to get another big one. The only other possible big legislative transformation that could happen on his watch would be immigration reform, and I don't think many people think that's particularly likely at the moment. So he's going to be judged on this. If it works out on balance better for people, I think he will be judged decently, but there are real questions of whether that's going to happen. And meanwhile, pursuant to the point about the economy, you know, he came in with his measures. By now, we should have seen a more robust recovery than what we have seen. And a lot will depend on what happens with his successor. If his successor is to him what Ronald Reagan was to Jimmy Carter on the economy, Obama will look terrible. However, if like a lot of economists like Tyler Cowen and other people have said, we're kind of in this new era of low growth and kind of high unemployment, and that's going to stretch on for 2 decades, then he's going to be seen more as the beginning of a new era. It's very hard to tell, but certainly I wouldn't bet on his presidency bringing a lot more of new domestic achievements under his watch.
Matt Welch with Reason Magazine. Jonathan Chait, back to you. You said what he'll be remembered for more likely is his efforts against climate change. What about his base? And do you think the base wanted him to spend more, not less, might have had a greater impact, as Matt Welch, to respond to Matt Welch's point. Also, with regard to the Affordable Care Act, they wanted to see a single payer.
Well, that's absolutely right. They gave up on that dream a long time ago. I agree with Matt Welch that what fundamentally matters here is what works. I don't think communications are the real issue. I don't even think poll numbers are the issue. What matters is, can they get it working? Now, a lot of those pieces are outside of his control. The main legislative item he was hoping for in the second term was immigration reform, hoping that the Republican Party would try to address its problems with non-white voters by just trying to take immigration off the table. But it's looking increasingly likely that they won't do that or just are unable to do that without putting too much pressure on the mainstream leaders of the party from the activist base. So you're left with this administrative question of the Environmental Protection Agency and climate change. The administrative problem of the Affordable Care Act, and can they make it work? And I'm much more optimistic than Matt Welch is that they will make it work. But how well they make it work remains to be seen. It could just come online very, very slowly and fitfully. And then you've got the economy. They've got some small room to operate there with the economy. You've got Republicans in Congress finally willing to make a small deal, not the big grand bargain that President Obama and a lot of centrists wanted on tax reform for entitlement reforms, but just try to get rid of sequestration for the next couple of years. The automatic cuts of sequestration are imposing significant headwinds on the recovery and have been for several years now. So we're no longer stimulating the economy, we're destimulating the economy, and that anti-stimulus that Washington has been imposing has caused unemployment to remain high. So if Congress actually can pass this deal and put off some of these automatic cuts, then you could really see an acceleration of the economy, and that could really change the landscape in a lot of ways.
Okay. Big question is whether Congress wants to do that, certainly with the midterm elections coming up. I want to introduce our final guest, Richard Schenkman, who's presidential historian, associate professor of history at George Mason University. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
What about the so-called curse of the second term, which Matt Welch referred to earlier? Is the president, do you think, suffering from that?
He shouldn't be. He is at the trough of his political popularity. He should be at the peak of his political popularity. Of the seven two-term presidents since FDR, four were higher at this point in their presidencies, in their second terms, and considerably higher than Obama. Three were under 50, and that's Nixon, Bush 2, and Obama, and that should be cold comfort to the White House. He's not in very good company right now.
What is it about second terms that makes it so difficult for presidents?
Well, I think one of the main problems is that by the time you're in your second term, you have accumulated a lot of enemies, and you've even alienated a lot of people in your own base. When you first come on the scene, everybody's excited about you, and they will forgive you if on this issue or that issue you don't happen to agree with them. But after you're into the fifth, sixth, seventh year, well, now you've wound up doing a lot of stuff that even the people on your own side who are inclined to support you will find an accumulation of grievances that will tip you toward the negative. So I think that's part of what's going on here. The larger problem that I think that he's got right now is he's got two C problems, a credibility problem and a competence problem. And both of those are devastating to the reputations and popularity of presidents. His credibility problem, of course, is because he said if you like your plan, you can keep it. People are discovering that's not the case. But even more important is the competence problem. Voters want to believe that their presidents are competent. When social scientists do headshot face tests on voters, and voters look at these series of faces, what is the one quality, the one trait that they want in a political leader? It is competence. That's even more important than likability, and it's more important, if you can believe it, than trust. Well, what the rollout of the Obamacare website has done is really raised doubts about his competence. It's a little bit of like what happened with Bush 2 with Katrina. Obviously not on the same scale, and the human toll is not the the same. But the reason both of these issues, credibility and competence, are so vital is because politics is all about issues susceptible to public debate. Most Americans could not explain to you, could not begin to explain to you what the Affordable Care Act is all about. But a competence issue and a credibility issue, they get it. So even low-information voters get these two metrics, and that's a real problem for them.
Much of politics is about perception. That's why we have pollsters. Let me go back to our pollsters. First, David Winston, Republican pollster with the Winston Group. Do you think that the president has time, has the competence, if you will, to overcome these issues that we've talked about and get something done before his term is over?
Oh, I absolutely. I think any president, given the amount of time that he has the opportunity, but again, part of it is also the circumstances he's dealing with in terms of what's going to be emerging and what policies he's going to lay out and what different directions he has at his disposal that he can go. I think part of the problem that President Obama has faced here is, one, this is his signature issue, and it's not like he can walk away from the health care issue and try to move on to something else. I mean, this has got to be a success. And one of the things that's unclear at this point is, where are we going to be at 6 months? Again, because there's this big number in terms of, do 7 million people sign up? That's going to be something that will be there no matter what happens. Having said that, part of his challenge and part of the leadership challenge is, when you're faced in a situation like this, and again, the one thing the country wants addressed is the economy, what does he do to really drop that unemployment rate? What does he do to get the economy moving again? If he can solve that, he'll do well. But if he can't, what it will do is reinforce exactly the problem that was defined before, his ability and capability to get things done. And once people start to lose confidence, it is hard to reestablish.
Stanley Greenberg, our Democratic pollster, what about the political climate that has been remarked about so often by so many people? And does he have an opportunity to come back now, given the relentlessness of the Republican opposition?
Yeah, I think he has time, and I actually don't view this as a second term problem. I mean, after all, we're barely through the first year of the second term, and the problems that we identified at the outset, not providing a narrative and educating on the economy and letting people know what the core economic policies were, what Jonathan talked about on climate change, some of the biggest changes he will have done, which have to do with fuel efficiency and the steps he's taking on energy and coal, are big changes. But as I mentioned in the Republic, I expected that he would not talk about that after he actually made the policy change. And now we have health care. And so there are big changes that are unfolding, which I think the White House has an immense opportunity to move to an educative role. And what he has to add to that, and others have spoken to this, he has to step up on the economy. I know we have gridlock. I know we have a Republican determined to stop him. But healthcare is going to move through. Energy policies and climate change are policies that are genuinely going to happen on a big scale. He's got a battle for growth on the economy, even if he can't get the Congress to go with him to point a direction that he would take the country, because people aren't willing to have a politics that does not deal with the economy that grows and creates jobs that pay. And so I feel there's plenty of time for this. I mean, I think the question is, just a lot of this was true in the first term. I think the issue is, how they facing this loss of confidence. I think that's an opportunity to say, we're going to do this in a different way. We're going to be more educative. We're going to talk about these initiatives.
Let me go back to Matt Welsh, editor-in-chief of Reason magazine. You said earlier that 47% of people want to identify themselves as independent, even though they may or may not be registered with one of the parties. How much of a challenge does that pose, do you think, for the president, if, in fact, people aren't going according to party lines anymore?
Well, that just means that voters are acting more like free agents, and they're going issue by issue in ways, and they can't be sort of reliably depended on at every moment. An example of this you saw, and I think it's fed into some of the dynamics we've talked about, was earlier this summer, the president took a pretty big hit among young voters who've traditionally been with him and other progressives who've been interested in civil liberties during the whole unfolding Edward Snowden NSA scandals. A lot of people voted for Obama thinking they're getting rid of Darth Cheney once and for all, and are kind of alarmed to see that many, not all, but many of the Bush-Cheney proposals have been extended in some ways. So what you saw was, now there's a bipartisan coalition, and it's only on this one issue about civil liberties that has arisen against the leadership of both parties, but with some interesting public opinion support out there that wants to do things like partially defund the NSA or roll back areas of the Patriot Act. That's what independents do. They say, I will make coalition in this one moment with Jonathan Chait, because we agree about this one issue, even though we disagree about everything else. So they're not as reliable, and that makes it more difficult to kind of mobilize public opinion to the extent to which the president needs to mobilize public opinion, because as we've been talking about here, the president is in charge of a gigantic regulatory apparatus, so he can do those Chait-like changes to the regulatory process on energy, and he, of course, is in charge of the military, and second-term presidents are, have been known sometimes to use the military as well. So he will be able to still exercise his power going forward, maybe despite public opinion and not necessarily with public opinion, but it's just, it just remains the fact second-term presidents, their parties during midterm elections, you know, 12 out of the last 13 times have just taken a beating. The only exception to that, which might end up being relevant here, is Bill Clinton after the impeachment summer when people got sick of Republicans. So we'll see if Republicans find a way to mismanage this one like they've mismanaged so many else in the past.
Jonathan Chait, you've been referred to a couple of times by Matt Welch. Let me go back to you. What about the NSA? What about the drones, the damage to the president's reputation with his base, particularly among young people and those concerned about civil liberties?
Yeah, you know, he's always had some issues, especially on foreign policy, national security issues with the left. He's never been on the left of those issues the way a lot of the Democratic base wanted. But I don't agree that this is manifesting itself in terms of any deeper change or loosening of partisan ties. Now, it's true that more people identify themselves as independents when they're asked by pollsters than have before. But I'm guessing, now I'm sure both pollsters you have, if you ask them, will back me up on this point. This does not mean that people are less partisan. It simply means that people want to identify themselves as independents. But many of these independents actually vote for a party or one party or another in a more reliable way than people who identify themselves as a partisan. So, and again, please, you should ask your pollsters about this question, but it's come up twice. A lot of people who will say, will call themselves Democrats, say people, for instance, in Arkansas, West Virginia, call themselves Democrats, vote Republican more frequently than many people who are independents or even Republicans will do. People keep these labels for a long time, but the labels aren't necessarily predictive of their voting behavior.
We're going to have to leave the polling question to another program. I want to go back to Richard Schenkman one more time, our presidential historian at George Mason University. You said that the problems the president has now are credibility and competence. You too believe that he has time. What does he need to do?
Well, the most important thing for Obama is that he's got to continue to hope that his adversaries keep fighting amongst themselves. That will really work to his advantage. He could sit in the White House and say nothing. But as long as the Republicans are divided and at war with each other, that'll really work. The other thing, of course, is the economy's got to come back. If the economy does well, his poll numbers will shoot up. If the economy doesn't, that's why the numbers that came out this morning, even though the stock market probably doesn't like to hear that we did so well last quarter, because that means that now the Fed will be inclined to lift its foot off the gas pedal. Still, that's tremendous news for this White House. So if we get a couple of quarters with high growth, people are going to feel good about themselves, and then they'll think twice about that competency issue. All of a sudden, they will say, the president's doing a good job because the economy's doing well. And even though he may or may not deserve credit for the economy doing well, they will transfer that credit to him anyway. That's what people do.
That's all the time we have for the moment. I hope all of you will join us again. Richard Schenkman at George Mason University, Matt Welch at Reason, Jonathan Chait with New York Magazine, David Winston, our Republican pollster, Stanley Greenberg, a Democratic pollster. Good to have you all. Many thanks for being with us. The presidential campaign of 2008 was one of the most dramatic in decades. The bestseller Game Change took readers behind the scenes with Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin and the candidates of both parties. It was turned into an HBO movie. Now, the same authors have followed up with Double Down. That's an account of last year's campaign. We'll be back in a moment with co-author Mark Halperin on To the Point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Warman, I'll be back with today's talking point. Double Down is subtitled Game Change 2012. Mark Halperin, also of Time Magazine, is a co-author, along with John Heilman of New York Magazine and MSNBC. Mark Halperin joins us now. It's good to have you on our program.
Warren, great to be back. Thank you.
I think you heard the very last part of our conversation a moment ago, and one thing that occurs to me immediately is that we heard that the president has failed in many ways to speak to his base, to emphasize the kinds of issues that they want to hear about. You have in your book an anecdote about him coming into a meeting with a yellow pad full of notes saying that he wanted to do exactly what the other guest said he didn't do.
Well, Warren, you've pointed out one of the scenes in the book that John Heilman and I think is the most revelatory about the president. He came to a political meeting in the fall of 2011, just as he was gearing up for re-election at a time when he was in many ways at the low point of his first term politically. And David Axelrod, his advisor at the previous in the series of political meetings, had urged the president to come in to talk about some of the issues he felt were important to him. And the president showed up. The president's kind of an inveterate list maker. And he showed up with, written in longhand, a number of issues that he wanted to talk about. Things like climate change, things like gay marriage, gay rights, things like poverty, closing Guantanamo Bay. And the list was things that he didn't talk about much, with the exception of gay marriage, which was kind of forced upon him in that last year of the first term. But it does give insight into kind of where the president's heart was and some of the frustration he felt at the time and still feels about having to accommodate to the political realities of Washington, particularly a Washington where one of the houses of Congress is controlled by the other party.
So what about his advisors, though, and what were they telling him to do? Were they getting him to move away from where his heart really was?
Well, they were politically realistic, and so was the president. He wasn't so much saying these were the things he wanted to run on in the real world, but rather part of the second-term agenda. And in fact, if you look at this scene in Double Down where he reads the list and compare what he talked about there privately to what he talked about in his inaugural address for the second term, there's a pretty healthy overlap. The difference is, again, the president and his aides felt he couldn't run on, say, something like climate change at a time when the economy was still struggling, when so many Democrats did not want to run on cap and trade or any other proposed solution. And that left him struggling somewhat during the campaign to engage voters on anything except I'm better than Mitt Romney.
Bringing the book right up to date, there's a lot in the book about the vetting by Mitt Romney of vice presidential candidates. And one of them was Chris Christie, the man who just won this overwhelming victory for re-election in the state of New Jersey and is now regarded as a potential presidential candidate in 2016. What did the Romney campaign find out about Chris Christie that caused them to look the other way?
Warren, Chris Christie is certainly the man of the moment. He's on the cover of Time Magazine today, my magazine, and a lot of discussion, as you said, after Tuesday's overwhelming re-election. But one of the many times he shows up in Double Down as a pretty compelling character is when he is one of five men considered by Mitt Romney to be on the ticket. Governor Romney's team found a range of things in Chris Christie's background, some of which are a matter of public record and somewhat well-known in New Jersey, but not very well-known nationally. And none of them stood out as sort of the ultimate smoking gun, but all of them raised questions, particularly for Governor Romney when he was presented with this final vetting report that we quote from in Double Down, which Governor Romney thought, you know what, any one of these things could blow up and become a distraction, and there's so many that it'd be kind of a risky thing. So although he was being urged by one of his political advisors to pick Chris Christie because he was such a good street fighter, Governor Romney decided to pass on him, and I think it's clear that many of those issues that are raised, including, for instance, Governor Christie was once a lobbyist for an organization at the time headed by Bernie Madoff. Many of those issues, I think, are going to be picked over not just by Democrats, not just by the media, but by a lot of Republicans who want to stop Chris Christie from being their nominee in 2016.
That takes us back to the Republican follies, if you will, of last year. To what extent were they as interesting and as transformative, to go back to the reference to a game change, as what happened in 2008?
Look, the reality is the Republican Party nomination fight in 2012 is totally reflective of where things are with the party right now. Mitt Romney was not a favorite either of the Wall Street crowd who, although Governor Romney had ties to that group, very much wanted Chris Christie, who we talked about before, or Mitch Daniels, the governor, former governor of Indiana, to get into the race. But nor was Governor Romney the kind of hero of the Tea Party movement. And so you see in the other candidates who run, many of whom had their turn at the top of the polls, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, even Herman Cain, Donald Trump, you see in their ephemeral success an indication of the weakness of Mitt Romney, to be sure, but also a snapshot and a sort of a window into the difficulties the Republican Party had last time and is still having about how do they find someone who can bridge those two groups and then go on to appeal to independents and to Democrats. So I think that the characters are pretty rich. Newt Gingrich has been on the national scene for so many years, extraordinarily compelling character. Rick Santorum, also to us, a very interesting character. And Mitt Romney, who some people kind of talk about as not that interesting, I think readers of Double Down are going to see sides of him, both positive and negative, politically adroit and politically less adroit, that are, I think, pretty revealing and pretty compelling in the context of an election where the stakes were so very high.
Back to the Democrats. What about the moment, and I take it was more than a moment, when there was real consideration about switching the ticket on the Democratic side and replacing Joe Biden with Hillary Clinton?
That goes back to that period I was talking about before, the fall of 2011, after a very tough fight the president had the previous round, not the most recent one, with the Republicans over debt, the debt ceiling and the budget. The president came out of that fight in the summer of 2011, very bruised politically, people seeing in him weakness, both from the left and the right. And the president was frustrated, and his advisors were worried. Although they didn't have they had a lot of confidence that Mitt Romney would be the nominee, they didn't find him very formidable. They thought the president was in danger of losing his job. And so they considered a range of things, including by the White House chief of staff then, Bill Daley, David Plouf, David Axelrod, the president's top two political advisors. They said, do we need to consider the option of replacing Joe Biden with Hillary Clinton? Clearly, there'd be a downside there. But they saw a potential upside. They did a poll. They did some focus group work to try to figure out if a Clinton, if an Obama-Clinton ticket would make the president stronger than an Obama-Biden ticket. In the end, the research came back. It did not show a big bump, and therefore the downside outweighed the positive. But again, the fact that at that level they decided to spend money, consider that option, shows you not just how worried they were about the president's reelection, but it's one piece of data on this arc that we trace very closely in the book, where Barack Obama finishes the 2008 election at war with the Clintons, and by the end of this election, close enough to consider, his team consider putting her on the ticket, and to have Bill Clinton become his strongest and perhaps most effective ally in the last election, something we write about quite a bit in Double Down.
Double Down, Game Change 2012. Mark Halperin, thanks a lot for being on our program. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.